Welcome to Fertility and Sterility on Air, the podcast where you can stay current on the latest global research in the field of reproductive medicine. This podcast brings you an overview of this month's journal, in-depth discussion with authors, and other special features. FNS on Air is brought to you by Fertility and Sterility family of journals in conjunction with the American Society for Reproductive Medicine and is hosted by Dr. Kurt Barnhart, Editor-in-Chief, Dr. Eve Feinberg, Editorial Editor, Dr. Micah Hill, Media Editor, and Dr. Pietro Bordoletto, Interactive Associate-in-Chief.
Welcome to all of our listeners to Fertility and Sterility on Air. We're going through the April journal this month. I'm Micah Hill, the media editor, and we have a full team with you here today. Our editor-in-chief, Kurt Barnhart. Good morning, Kurt. How are you?
Good morning, Micah. Great to be here.
Good. Good to see you. And then we have Eve and Pietro, and I want to just call on you each one at a time, because since we last met, a lot has happened in our field. You can't turn on any news without seeing talk about IVF and the Alabama coverage. And Eve and Pietro, I've sort of seen your names all over some of this material in the media. So Eve, I'll just start with you. Give us the sort of elevator pitch of what you've been doing in the last couple of weeks as a result of this Supreme Court decision in Alabama.
Yeah, it's been a busy last few weeks. I've been doing my best to write opinion pieces talking about the science behind IVF and how we should separate the idea that life begins with fertilization from when a citizen should be protected. So I had the pleasure of being interviewed by Sanjay Gupta, who is just an amazing interviewer, and made some media appearances on outlets such as CNN and NPR.
Great. Thank you. And Pietro, you had a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. You were actually here in D.C. last week. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I think once-in-a-lifetime doesn't begin to describe it. I never dreamed that far in my dreams, and I never even had it on my bucket list. But I, along with a couple of other folks in our field, were invited to attend the State of the Union last week in D.C. as guests of our different local representatives and senators as a result of what happened in Alabama. I think people on both sides of the aisle are pretty spooked about IVF access and the way that the folks in Congress raise the issue on a federal level is they invite a guest and then they go around with that guest and give interviews basically all morning before the actual State of the Union. Myself, Amanda Adelaide, Barb Collira, there's a bunch of folks in our field that were there giving interviews and talking about the issues and talking about the need for federal IVF protections and the need for sidestepping local partisan politics and ensuring that people have access to IVF regardless of their zip code. And I think we really got the message out. And I think the coolest part for me was hearing from the president himself. His guest was one of the families affected by the Alabama Supreme Court ruling at the State of the Union. And I think for the first time in the history of our field, it was mentioned at a State of the Union, which was cool. And you've been hearing him talk a little bit more about it just over the last couple of days as he's been on the campaign trail pushing his agenda for 2024. So I think the big takeaway for me, I think Eve probably agrees with me, is what we could be doing as a field is talking about it. I think it's on us to write about it, to give the interviews, to talk to folks who maybe don't know enough about this issue and share our expertise. Because when I was meeting with members of Congress, they were interested in hearing from what I had to say as an expert, which I think was refreshing. But I think all of us need to be doing that on a local level, on a state level, certainly on a national level when the opportunity presents itself.
Pietro, I couldn't agree with you more. I think this is one of the few times in our field that the theoretical is meeting the road with the practical. And we have to really be able to say it clearly and say it loudly that not only does it have practical implications, but also push back at some of the theory that got us here in the first place. So this is a chance for us to stand up and really say our thoughts and piece.
I will tell you, if you have the opportunity or have connections with your local newspaper, they are hungry for these kinds of stories. They sometimes just don't know who to reach out to. Sometimes I think this is an opportunity for us to have reaching out to them and wanting to tell our story. And Eve, I think, has done a wonderful job in doing this through podcasting, but also just writing opinion pieces. I encourage everyone to think about ways that they can be, quote unquote, evangelizing over the next couple of weeks.
Great. Thank you, everyone. And thank you for your advocacy and to, you know, ASRM and the leadership there for everything that they've been doing. As bad as it was to see that Supreme Court ruling, the response to it, I think, has been overall positive. And hopefully we'll see good things come out of this at the end. But it's certainly important times for our field. So let's dive into the journal this month and into the science that we have. We're going to start with the front matter from our team of editorial editors. Our views and reviews are from Laura Rienzi, and she looks at fertility preservation and some old perspectives, some new perspectives, and what's coming down the pipeline, and has the help of Dom DeZiegler, another one of our editorial editors. Definitely worth a good read. We have sort of a classic battle in our fertile battles. It's to ICSI or not to ICSI. These are debates that a lot of us have done. I know Kurt and I have done these at FNS events, at ASRM, and sort of a classic debate for 20 years in our field. Peter Schlegel, editorial editor, reproductive urologist, is the one that does this. And he has a group of two experts. He's got, on the pro side, Palermo. So who better than the one who sort of discovered ICSI and talking about its uses and its benefits. And on the other side, on the con side, he has Professor Aitken, who sort of looks at the potential harms of ICSI. Is it an add-on? Are we overusing it? I think probably we'd have a hard time arguing we don't overuse it. And is there a chance that we're actually doing some harm to it? Is that natural selection of sperm competing in the fallopian tubes or the petri dish a helpful thing for human reproduction? Does it help us bypass disease? Are we passing on disease by doing things like ICSI? But what I liked the most about this was the personal perspective from Peter Schlegel towards the end of his intro. He says, personally, the ability to perform micromanipulation of gametes and enhance assisted reproductive outcomes is what drove me to enter andrology and male reproduction in the first place. It's not clear how or why this ability to bypass compromised or immature spermatozoa to fertilize eggs helps, but it was a clear opportunity for me to treat many men who were previously relegated to donor sperm. Contrary to what Professor Edwards says, that ICSI was the death of andrology, I would argue that ICSI was a revolutionary benefit to our andrologic teams and allow us to understand sperm. What a gift to the andrologist. So to me, that Peter sort of summed it up as, don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. We can say ICSI might be overused. We're probably doing it too much. There may be some harm for some people, but it's one of the Mount Rushmores of tools since IVF was invented in the IVF world, I would say. So a great contribution from Peter. And then Eve, you did the inkling to sleep, perchance to dream, ... of pregnancy. And Eve and her team explore some of the data around sleep and how sleep might be detrimental to reproduction, as some evidence suggests in shift workers and others. But really, there's just the lack of evidence. We know that sleep is very important. It's associated with a lot of medical and metabolic outcomes that can be negative and potentially reproductive outcomes. So I think the take-home point that I took from Eve's article was we need to do more research on sleep and reproduction. Read it and see what you think for yourself of all three of these great topics. We're going to dive right into the science. Kurt, you get the seminal article this month. We're talking about fertility outcomes after cancer in reproductive aged women.
Sure. Thanks, Micah. I just wanted to comment that those three pieces you mentioned are just bread and butter of our field. Laura Rienza speaking about cryopreservation is probably the biggest advancement in IVF, the fact that we actually can cryopreserve. I know it dovetails into the Alabama ruling and such, but I mean, without cryopreservation, our field would really be stifled. And that's not to overlook ICSI, which I agree with you is the Mount Rushmore. But, you know, whenever we have a technology, it's awfully hard not to overuse it in everything outside of reproduction. When you get a hammer, you start hammering. So that's another thing in our field. And again, I think what Eve is diving into is really an important cross-section between reproductive medicine and regular medicine. There's no question that sleep affects people's health. How it exactly affects reproduction is still a bit of a black box. I'm really glad that people are delving into it. So I couldn't help but editorialize on that great editorial content in our journal. So I hope that you will take a look at that other than just listening to us on some of the articles. So this month's seminal article is The Use of Fertility Treatment Among Reproductive Aged Women After Cancer by Lauren Kipling and Penelope Howards are the first and senior author. And we're out of Emory University. And it's a good collaboration between the infertility department and the pediatrics department. You know, spoiler alert here, this is a really important topic, but unfortunately, it's probably going to end up telling you what you think you might have already known, but it's still worth going through the paper. The question here is to examine whether female cancer survivors, which with no question is more prevalent now than it has been because of all the wonderful work of our pediatric oncologists and such. But if you're a cancer survivor, are you more likely to pursue infertility care after your cancer than, let's just for the sake of purposes, say the general population. It's an interesting question because there's a lot of things that go into this. It's not just medicine, it's intent, it's your family situation, it's resources. So it's a really hard question to answer. So the way they tried to tackle this was a population-based cohort where they had direct interviews regarding reproductive history. They have a wonderful opportunity here where they have a registry of cancer survivors that are aged 22 to 45, who are at least 2 years after their cancer diagnosis. We're talking about 1,000 patients, 1,036 to be example, and they age match them to women with no cancer history, relatively equal number. And we might delve into the method a little bit. They modeled it in a sense. They get matched to different people in repetitive times to have some robustness to the answer that they got. So there are a lot of pearls that you can pick up that are interesting here. And I'll just go through some of the main results. So first of all, the big question in my mind was starting off the population, the people that had cancer, did they already have their family? Did they want a family? And the baseline question here is that only about 25% of them reported that their family had been completed by the time of their diagnosis. I guess looking back, that doesn't surprise me because these are relatively young women. And then we go through the specifics, and it ends up that cancer survivors were more likely to report not having children at the interview compared to those with no cancer history. We're talking about a third compared to about 20%. So again, not huge numbers. And those numbers surprised me, that it's only a third and only 20% of people in that age reported not having the family size that they wanted. But survivors were not more likely to visit a doctor for help to become pregnant compared to the general population. And they were not more likely to use some of the treatments. Specifically, they looked at ovulation induction and IUI, and they came up with an odds ratio of about 1.16, which was not statistically significant. The only thing that did come up to be significantly significant was the use of surgery, which I have some thoughts about as well. What exactly does that mean about surgery to improve your fertility? But that the group of cancer survivors were more likely to use surgery than those that not. So that's the highlight. And I'll gladly go through some specifics based on your guys' reactions. But what did you think of those findings overall? Did they surprise you, or was there some subtlety there?
I think that the fact that it wasn't limited to those patients who hadn't completed their families, definitely one of the flaws of this study. They also did a subgroup analysis looking at those who had gonadotoxic chemotherapy and what the effect of gonadotoxic chemotherapy is. I also think they included some patients who had DCIS or very early cancers that probably would not impact overall fecundability. And so I think that at a broad strokes level, you can say that looking at this very broadly, that cancer and chemotherapy may not increase the likelihood of pursuit of ART in the future. But I also think if you look at perhaps what are some of the limitations to ART, like there were some, this study was limited in that it didn't allow, let me re-say that. If we look at perhaps some of the limitations of ART, I think it's hard to know what proportion of these patients are in mandated states, had access to ART, were able to afford ART. I also think some of it may be some of the mental health barriers with longevity, health, reproduction. I think it's very multifactorial. And I worried a little bit as I read this that people would think that cancer doesn't affect somebody's likelihood of having a baby, but it was really just that in this population of patients, which is very broad, that they didn't seek ART assistance at higher rates than their matched controls. But it doesn't mean that they weren't infertile or that they didn't face barriers to building their family.
Yeah, that's the jumping point I had too, Eve. I mean, I was amazed that there's little information on this. And the preliminary data, they said that how many people, cancer survivors, actually use fertility treatments, and the cross-sectional data they had prior to this was only about 15%. But 15% is roughly the use of the general population. So you could look at this in two ways. They weren't any more or any less likely, because I did pull out some pearls that there's a lot of negative impact on people that are cancer survivors. There's a lot of fatalistic approach. There's a lot of, well, I'll take what I'm given, or I don't want the extra pursuit, or things like that. So you can see there's lots of reasons to drive the needle down, just as many reasons as there to drive the needle up, saying, you know, we advocate for every person with cancer to preserve their fertility in case they want to. But there's a lot of competing factors here that ends up to be in the middle. And I prefer to look at this optimistically. Just as many cancer survivors use infertility services as the general population. So that's a lot of people.
It's important to highlight that this was actually only women in the state of Georgia, and were matched to women within the state of Georgia as well. So you're really looking at a non-mandated state experience here in utilization of ART. I'd be very curious to see what this looks like in Illinois, what it looks like in Massachusetts, where we've had longstanding mandates. And I think utilization for some of these services would probably be higher, but I don't know.
Well, and I think it's really hard when you take all cancers, right? Like there are so many different impacts of different types of cancers on reproduction. But again, like this wasn't really a study looking at does cancer cause infertility? It was a study of do cancer survivors utilize ART services? And I think, you know, to your point, Kurt, there are so many competing interests and so many different things that factor into decision-making around treatment. I think it's really important to understand what this study looked at and really, quite honestly, like what it didn't tell us. It didn't tell us that cancer survivors are less likely to have infertility. It just said that they're going to utilize ART services at the rate of the general population.
Kurt, you sort of mentioned it, but the one statistically significant finding was cancer survivors were more likely to use surgery to help become pregnant. I didn't do a deep dive on that. What were your thoughts from reading the article on why that might be, or Pietro?
I think I know what that is. I think we're talking about bread and butter stuff, polypectomies, hysteroscopic myomectomies, septums. I can't imagine we're talking about tubal reanastomosis. We're talking about fimbrioplasty. I think we're talking about pretty bread and butter surgical procedures to enhance fertility. But it's specifically spelled out.
They said they thought that the bias there was endometriosis. They thought for whatever reason there was a greater search for and treatment of endometriosis, which tilted the needle towards statistical significance. And I thought about that, and I said, well, it doesn't surprise me. All of these women most likely had some sort of surgical diagnosis and surgical treatment, and therefore they're kind of reliant on surgery more than the general population. But again, what struck me odd is surgery is not exactly the way we enhance fertility. So I didn't want to read too much into it. It was, you know, the fourth down in their secondary outcomes.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, again, in a non-mandated state where access is an issue and cost is an issue, surgery is often covered by insurance. And so I think it's a reasonable thing to say in somebody who's not getting pregnant, who can't afford to access ART, well, let's see if perhaps surgery may help you conceive.
So I want to end this discussion with, why is this a seminal article? It's a negative study that really didn't teach me anything. But I want to say to everybody that what we're trying to do is pick really good science and thought-provoking science for the journal. And I think this is a good one to read. I also want to make sure that I'm addressing survivorship bias, and pun intended, this was meant to be a cancer study. But, you know, negative studies, if they're well done with a good hypothesis, will get good publicity and highlights in fertility and sterility. So the reason this was chosen was it's a bread and butter topic, great discussion, and it really was done well. And, you know, really well done studies deserve to see the light of day and inform us in many ways other than having a statistically significant finding.
Kurt, I'm just going to end with a personal anecdote. So you sort of talked about maybe a fatalistic view amongst cancer survivors or a different approach to their fertility. When I was a fellow, I was diagnosed with rectal cancer, and we had a blizzard in DC and it shut down the whole city. And so chemotherapy was closed for 2 weeks, and all of us who were going through chemo just accepted it, right? We couldn't get to the hospital. It wasn't safe. We'll delay the chemo. IVF at Walter Reed didn't shut down. Like, a doctor slept at the hospital for almost 2 weeks. The patients all found a way to get there, you know, trudging through snow. Some got skis. Like, they really went out of their way. And I do think there was a difference in sort of an acceptance that a cancer survivor patient sometimes goes through, and being happy with the life that they still have, and maybe having different motivations in what they pursue. So I do wonder how much that plays into this. I know the study couldn't delve into that thought process, but I thought that was an interesting comment from you. So we're going to move on to reproductive endocrinology. And Kurt, we're coming right back to you. We're moving on to assisted reproduction and coming right back to you, Kurt, on oxygen tension. I think we know that low oxygen is good in the lab in general, but now we're looking at it specifically for IVM and not blast development.
I feel important this morning. So the study you're referring to, of course, is the impact of oxygen tension during the in vitro maturation process. So this is, you're right, a little bit different than IVF straightforward culture. This is a pretty specific culture. And this was also called a sibling oocyte prospective double-blind study. I am not going to try to pronounce that. Balmer-Dossi? Yeah, the study is from Balmer-Dossi and Seifer And this study is done from some very nice academic practices in France. So again, the story here is this is incremental but good science, where there's been not much of a debate, but kind of a moving towards more physiologic oxygen, which is low oxygen, because the oxygen tension in the fallopian tube, as you were talking about with ICSI before, is actually relatively low, as opposed to atmospheric oxygen, which for whatever reasons, and I'm curious to ask you, all of you guys, this, why did we start at atmospheric oxygen tensions in the lab in the first place? To digress a little bit, I don't know if it was paternalistic, that that's all we knew how to do, or we didn't understand the physiology, but it's one of those things in medicines where we probably one of the fundamental decisions about culture was incorrect. And now we've been slowly moving towards the more physiologic. So this study is looking at in vitro maturation, kind of the final frontier in ART. And it looks at a single site with a large number of patients that have IVM for specific reasons. IVM, if you go back historically, was originally kind of thought to be plausible for someone like PCOS, where we were getting so many eggs and hyperstimulating them decades ago that we thought maybe it would be better to achieve eggs and easier to achieve eggs without hyperstimulation. But now it's really relegated for really kind of niche opportunities, patients with hypogonadotropic hypogonadism, people that are not responding to gonadotropins for whatever reasons and defects. So it's really not commonly used. What's kind of intriguing about this is not the hypothesis or the indication, but what intrigues me, and I think I'll get Micah to talk about a little bit, is this is a sibling oocyte study, and that has pros and cons. So what they did was they basically took their entire population for a couple of years, and as they matured them, they randomized their oocytes, assuming there was more than one, to two different culture techniques, and then looked at the outcomes. Now, I'll praise the study first. The primary outcome was percentage of maturation. And you couldn't use live birth in this outcome because not all of these patients are using these embryos. And many of these are for fertility preservation. So live birth kind of came off the table as a feasibility outcome. So the percentage of mature oocytes, M2 oocytes, was the outcome. The secondary outcomes were not just the percentage, but the quality. And now we get a little bit fuzzy in what's quality, and they had a score. I honestly didn't recognize the score that they used, but it was well spelled out. And they did go through some rigor to say that they had some inter and intra variability and accuracy of the embryologist assessing it. But essentially, they're looking at size and nuclear ratio and aspects of the oocytes themselves as what's a good or bad quality. And I'll leave it at that. So the answer to this study, which was, we could argue about this, but it looks like it was appropriately powered. They did suggest that the power was to find a 15% difference in oocyte maturation. I might argue that's a pretty large difference to be looking for, but they did have an a priori hypothesis. But the hypothesis did not turn out to be true. It ended up to be that the percentage of oocytes was pretty much the same. It was roughly 57.8 in one group and 56.8 in another group, which about is equal to what they were finding in other laboratory and other papers as well. So the primary outcome was null, but the secondary outcome about the quality was a little bit better and demonstrably better. And they concluded that perhaps you're getting better quality oocytes with this maturation at lower oxygen tension. So again, my high level feeling of this paper was, it needs to be done. It's incremental science. It's been hard, even in IVF culture, to show that low oxygen tension was better than normal tension, or at least what we started at. The RMN had a study that looked at this as well. They called it FOX, for physiologic oxygen tension. And we had a lot of trouble getting that published in the journal because, it showed that the pregnancy rate was the same, but the blast quality was slightly better, and no really good journal wanted to publish the secondary outcome as the finding. So I don't understand why this is one of these intuitive aspects. Like, we all think we started in the wrong place. We all think the lower oxygen tension is better, but for whatever reason, evidence-based medicine is having a hard time demonstrably proving that it's better. But no one's really paying attention to that, and everyone has moved to lower oxygen tension. So it's one of these things in medicine where we didn't need the evidence to convince us to do it. So that's why I like this paper, and I'm glad it's an FNS. So it's another nail in the coffin to saying, why are we using high oxygen tension, which might result in oxidative stress and damage? We can't prove that that theory works, but come on, guys, why are we still doing this? And here's some more data that says we should be doing physiologic oxygen tension.
So I don't disagree with you on that, but I think the bigger question is, why are we doing IVM in these patients who like have a legitimate need for fertility preservation? And when you look at the data that are presented in this paper on the number of oocytes retrieved, it's remarkably low, with many of these patients having to go through an additional round. But if you look at, I think the average was 6 M2s per cycle. And so I think as we have started to do more warming cycles, I think we're gaining a much better appreciation for just how many mature oocytes you need in order to have a blastocyst, and then how many blastocysts you need in order to have a live birth. And so I think, like, yes, I totally agree with you. This shows that low oxygen tension is just fine in this. Didn't really show superiority, but didn't show inferiority. But I couldn't get over that initial question of why IVM in this particular situation as opposed to a more traditional short-term random start stimulation where you would get 3 to 4 times the number of oocytes in a young population.
I can't answer that for you with the limited knowledge in this paper, the methods. Clearly, this group, again, it's a multi-one-center trial in France, has adopted this technique for a variety of people. It makes for an interesting study population, but I also agree. In the United States, in my practice, I'm not sure that many of these patients would have gone through IVM. So again, is it they found a hammer and it works for them, or is, you know, this, or they really a referral center for lots of people that need this niche treatment?
I think the only category of patient who I think this is probably a little bit different for, and I think this is what Eve's getting to, is the predicted high responder, right? The patient with the ultra high AMH, the PCOS patient. Those are the ones where I think the literature for IVM is a lot more reassuring. And there's some really nice data that's come out of the group from Belgium just very recently in human reproduction that's kind of shown that. But I agree with Eve, if you kind of got one shot at this, use the gold standard treatment to try to retrieve them largest amount of mature oocytes possible that you know have the best reproductive potential in the future for these patients.
Yeah, and I think with a Lupron trigger, I mean, I think, why are we so afraid of standard stimulation? And I can understand if it's a time factor that you have 3 days and you have to get some eggs out and this is your only choice. And I think that that's a really good tool that I would like to have in my toolbox, but it didn't seem like that was the case for the majority of these patients, especially considering that the treatments took place over multiple cycles. And so,
and the majority of patients had breast cancer, right? Which is not very, very rarely a need to start chemo tomorrow kind of diagnosis.
Yeah. And so I just wonder on the back end, are they getting enough oocytes? And what is that success rate going to look like on the back end with only 6 oocytes frozen from the majority of patients?
I think to that point, Eve, there's two different things at play in our field. There's the science of how do we make IVM better? Because obviously it's gone from very inefficient to somewhat efficient, but probably not as efficient as getting mature oocytes and doing conventional IVF with them. So from a science standpoint, I'm glad to see people working on these. But I agree, why, you know, is PCOS the ideal population when we can get 0% OHSS or a few case reports from Lupron trigger? I don't know. So I think there's two different things at play. Let's make the science of it better. And so I'm glad to see studies. And in that sense, PCOS makes sense because you're going to get a lot of eggs. So you sort of have a lot of wiggle room to play with. So I can see why people have scientifically started with that patient population. But the second and important question is, who do we clinically apply it to? I think certainly in the U.S., we've been slower to say this is a good thing to adapt, because I think we're going to lose our efficiency per egg as you're getting to the potential of each egg making a live birth. But I do think from a proof of concept, Kurt mentioned the sibling oocyte study. This is a great way to do proof of concept. So we say that lower tension IVM is going to result in better things for the egg. How can we measure that? Well, we can look at the fertilization. We can look at the egg score. They didn't go on to look at blastocysts, but ideally you'd sort of like to see blast development and good quality blast development. So this is a great way to do that, because with sibling oocytes, the patient's her own control and you can really improve your power with fewer patients. So I think that's why with roughly 100 patients, they're able to do this study instead of 1,000 patients being randomized one to each arm, which is a much harder thing to prove that final clinical efficacy. And I think Kurt covered it well, why you can't go on to live birth, because both groups won't be represented unless you transfer an embryo to each patient from each of the two groups. So you have to do two double embryo transfer. And I've only ever seen that done once over a decade ago by Richard Scott and Eric Foreman, where they DNA fingerprinted the embryos and transferred them both. And if it was a singleton birth, you could then test the baby and find out which embryo that came from within that patient. But in talking to them, they both agree you probably couldn't ethically do that study anymore, because how are you going to do a double embryo transfer in all patients? That's just not where the field has evolved to. So I think the sibling oocyte studies are great for sort of this proof of concept. Does the intervention actually do what we say it will do? But then long term, you would like to see the bigger, if it does, see the bigger RCTs to confirm it, which are much harder to do, as Kirk got to.
Yeah, right, Micah. Just to dogpile on that point, a sibling oocyte study is only going to end up with a surrogate outcome because you can't track that to live birth, because you're picking the best embryo out of many, and there's a lot of reasons. So if you really want live birth, you have to randomize patients, not oocytes, which has its own ups and downs ethically and things like that. But I just wanted to make it clear, because a lot of people put in sibling oocyte studies and try to extrapolate too far. This is an example of what it can do and what it can't do.
Great discussion. Eve, we're staying in assisted reproduction and coming to you with gestational surrogacy.
Thanks, Micah. This was a really nice study titled International Gestational Surrogacy in the U.S. from 2014 to 2020. And it was authored by Alexandra Herwick with senior author Heather Hipp from Emory. The objective was to describe characteristics, trends, and outcomes of international gestational surrogacy cycles within the United States. It was a retrospective cohort study. They used all ART cycles in the U.S. that were reported to SART that included an embryo transfer into a GC from 2014 to 2020. In addition to being a descriptive study looking at demographics, they also compared outcomes. The main findings of the study were as follows. So first, there were 40,000 GC cycles involving an embryo transfer. 32% of these were for international intended parents, and that number is a lot higher than I would have anticipated. Both groups, both international and U.S. native, experienced a decline in 2020 due to COVID-19 pandemic and travel restrictions. Figure one, for all of you, should go look at the paper. It's a beautiful graph showing the steady increase in GC cycles for both groups, and especially the increase in overall percentages of international cases. International intended parents were more likely to be male sex, identify as Asian. The five most common countries of origin were China, followed by France, Spain, UK, and Israel. 75% of international GC cases were performed in either California, who comprised 65% of the 75%, and Oregon was the next 10%. The next three most common states were Connecticut, Nevada, and Illinois. In comparison, GC cycles done in the U.S. were more evenly distributed, and the five most common states utilizing GCs were California, Texas, Connecticut, Illinois, and New York. International patients were less likely to have a double embryo transfer, but, SART highlight, the rates were still unacceptably high in both cases, 23.2% versus 27.5%. 67% of all international GC cases also utilized egg donors, and there was higher utilization of both ICSI and PGT in GC cycles. Outcomes including clinical pregnancy rates and live birth rates were not different. 50% of all GC live births were multiple gestations, and I think that really speaks to the 23% double embryo transfer rate. I think overall it was a nicely done study. I think it's really interesting. I think it really speaks to the biases against gay men internationally, especially in China, who are forced to travel to build families. I think it also does a nice job of capturing U.S. cross-border reproductive care overall and what the landscape looks like. I would be really interested in future studies examining other countries that also experience cross-border care to better understand the global trends and where other people are going. I see some eyes popping out. Pietro, go ahead.
Eve, tell me what you think about this multiple rate of 15% and with such a high utilization of PGT in these gestational carrier cycles. Are we putting back two euploids in gestational carriers? Is that how we were interpreting this?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the utilization of PGT and you look at the utilization of double embryo transfer, 27.5% of GC cycles in the that U.S. intended parents had double embryo transfer. I mean, that is unacceptably high.
It's unconscionable to do that, particularly in a gestational carrier where someone else is contributing their body.
It's amazing how they balance that, right? They're balancing because it's a high resource setting. You want to improve success at the cost of things. It's amazing how in different situations, the balance becomes different.
I don't know that it's improved. So having taken care of a lot of these couples, I don't know that it's improving success as much as it is the cost of using a gestational carrier has just also astronomically increased. And so I really think that it is this two for the price of one. And I hear this all the time in my own practice, and we do not do double embryo transfers into a GC, and we also don't do double embryo transfers with a donor egg. So when we see these same-sex male couples who come in who want double embryo transfer, one embryo from each partner, one cycle, we turn them away. But there are clinics, they will go down the street and they will get that care. And I understand that the cost of family building is astronomical in these couples. When you total up the bottom line of what does it cost for one GC journey, it's about $225,000. And so if you think about that's $225,000 to have one child, and many couples, and I completely understand this, would like to have two children. The incremental cost of having a second child in that same GC journey is minimal. And so there is this cost, I'm not even going to say benefit because it's not a benefit to anybody to have a twin pregnancy, but there is this cost efficiency in it. And I think that until there are some real changes to the cost structure of gestational surrogacy, including agency fees, which quite honestly are out of control at this point, I think it all needs to be scaled back in order to have safer provision of care. 27.5% double embryo transfer is not okay.
And this plays out as a prematurity rate, right? If you look at the preterm birth between 32 and 36 weeks in this cohort, it's 23%.
Yeah. And if you look at what are the long-term implications of prematurity, many of those children will go on to need additional services. And this is, I spend a lot of time counseling patients on this. You're not just talking about prematurity in the NICU for a few weeks. You may be talking about speech therapy, occupational therapy, lifelong therapies, or at least well into childhood, which then results in increased cost, many which are not covered by insurance or require time away from work, lost wages, et cetera. Like, I think that, yes, there's a cost savings in doing a single GC journey, but you're going to ultimately have that cost down the road. But it's very difficult to come up with money to do these cycles and to build your family.
What about just the immediate cost for the gestational carrier, right? Increased risk of growth restriction in twin pregnancies, hypertensive disorders of pregnancy, gestational diabetes, cesarean section, hemorrhage, hysterectomy. We're talking about multiples here in terms of risk for the gestational carrier themselves.
And I say this from like firsthand experience, it's not comfortable to carry a twin pregnancy. Like you are twice as big. I mean, truly, I don't say that lightly. It is not an easy pregnancy. And so the burden that it puts on the gestational carrier herself is not insignificant.
I just want to comment on that from the SART perspective. You know, this study is 2014 to 2020. And so it's a little bit older data. In 2020 is when the SART QA committee, I was chair at that time, we had two studies come out. One was from Dan Groh, who did a nationwide SART study on GCs and found this really high rate, what they're saying here. And Kate Devine, who was also on the committee, found a really high rate at the Shady Grove practice in GCs. And they were a little bit surprised because they've been very consistent with single embryo transfer. But for all the reasons we're talking about, not necessarily in this patient population, even from clinics, again, that really promote single embryo transfer. And so 2020 is around when we updated the guidance from ASRM and SART on embryo transfer. And we specifically, for the first time, put in GCs and strongly recommended it should be single embryo transfer, period. And actually, Kate and I and Dan were just emailing this morning that we need to look at the trend over time since that's been implemented, because we're probably getting to where we have enough data given the 2-year lag in SART reporting. My hope is that we're seeing these numbers drop, but we may not be. We need to look at the data to know that. And I think this is a huge issue and a safety issue, as you guys are saying, for the surrogates and for the offspring. All right. Great discussion. Single embryo transfer in GCs, but a lot of good other data that comes out of this, Eve, as you talked about. Eve, we're sticking with you. What does the day of the week and the moon have to do with our menstrual cycles?
Sounds like a Paul Simon song, doesn't it?
I really, really like this study. It was by Rene Ecochard and Claude Granefer from Lyon, France. And the title of the study is The Menstrual Cycles Influenced by Weekly and Lunar Rhythms. And admittedly, this is a topic I've thought very little about. So I thought it was eye-opening. And I also fully admit I had to go on NASA's webpage to refresh my memory on the phases of the moon. So several publications have reported a variation in health parameters according to the days of the week, suggesting a weekly rhythm known as circus septin that might exist. And so the objective of this study was to evaluate whether the menstrual cycle has a circus septin rhythm and whether it's associated with the lunar cycle, which is defined as the synodic month. It's the cycle of the phases of the moon as seen from Earth and averages 29 and a half days in length. So this was a cross-sectional study. They included 35,940 European and North American women ages 18 to 40 for a total of roughly 311,000 menstrual cycles. Data were collected over a 3-year period of time from women using the Natural Cycles app. Women with known PCOS, thyroid disease, endometriosis, and menopause were excluded. And also women who had irregular cycles were included. And that's an important point. Menstrual cycles were counted day one to day one, and then the lunar cycle was divided into 8 phases: new moon, waxing crescent, first quarter, waxing gibbous, full moon, waning gibbous, last quarter, and waning crescent. The number of each of the weekdays in each of the lunar phases varies in each lunar month. And so the null hypothesis was that no association exists of weekly or circolunar rhythms within menstrual cycles. The 2 variables they examined were days of menstruation during the week and then phase of menstruation during the lunar cycle. And interestingly, the authors found a clear and highly significant variation in the frequency of menstrual onset across days of the week, with the peak occurrence over Thursday and Friday. And this was much more pronounced in winter and for cycles that were 27 to 29 days, but persisted in every season, in every age group, and at every phase of the lunar cycle. The variation in lunar phase was less pronounced, but still reached statistical significance, with menses least likely to occur in the waxing crescent or the last quarter. So what do we make of these data? Interestingly, the circus septin rhythmicity of menstrual cycles has not been previously described. The question that remains is whether this is intrinsic and endogenous, or is this in response to variances in the sleep-wake cycle between weekdays and weekends, so-called social jet lag. And I think it's really difficult to say from these data, but provides a ripe opportunity for future research and some of my own interest with regard to sleep and reproduction. I can't help but wonder how much of this is due to sleep differential between weekend and the rest of the week. I think the data are really fascinating. I'm not sure what to do with them, but to quote Kurt, I think you just need to let them flow over you, pun intended. But I think that it's really interesting. And again, we're starting to think about what other factors may be involved in reproduction on a more global level.
And Eve, the you know, even though they found statistical variation, if you look at their figure 2, their graphs, they only the graphs only have 13 to 15% as far as like the days of the week is their, you know, their Y axis. And that's what it takes zooming in to see that there's any sort of variation by days of the week. When I trained in residency in the Army, they always made us put our graphs from zero to 100%. And if you did that, this would almost look like a flat line, but they have hundreds of thousands of people in these categories. So they're able to detect this, you know, is it 13% on this day, 14% on this day, 15%? This is really a tight range of variation that we're seeing in this data.
Yeah. And I think that, I mean, one of the advantages of a really large study with a lot of cycles is that you can see these nuanced differences and they can reach statistical significance because you have the power to detect it. But yeah, it's fascinating. And I think also like reproduction wise, if your first day of your menstrual cycle is on a Thursday or Friday, then you're going to be ovulating Thursday, Friday, weekend, 2 weeks later. Is this somewhat of an adaptation given that people may be more likely to want to try and conceive on a weekend as opposed to during the week? And is there some evolution at play behind this? Very subtle, but kind of interesting.
I love that you had to go to NASA to prep for this article. I thought that was a nice tidbit.
Eva, not, I'm just relying on memory here, but I remember data when I was training that menstrual cycles, you know, in populations or in areas would tend to coalesce in terms of the same cyclicity. How does this work or not work in that theory? Did the authors talk a little bit about that, how cycles might change?
Yeah, they did not get into it. And I think that's largely based on pheromones and the impact of pheromones on reproduction or on menstrual cyclicity. And it's true and very well described in females who live in the same household and dormitories and large group settings where women live together, jail, apparently. But yeah, they really didn't touch upon that at all in this study.
Good science. Thanks for sharing that one.
Let it flow over us, as Eve said. And, you know, I just want to highlight Beverly Reed, who wrote a really good reflection on this and the article I'm about to talk about. Jessica Zoltan wrote a good reflections. I enjoy the reflections when the writers of those don't just regurgitate the findings. We already have the abstract for that. But when they put it into context and sort of what does this mean for us? And I think these two people did a great job in those reflections. So we appreciate that. So I'm going to move us on into from gynecology into the field of reproductive endocrinology. And we have a paper titled AMH Level Predicts Ovulation in Women with PCOS Treated with Clomiphene and Metformin. This is senior author Komorowski, or first author Komorowski, senior author Boots from Northwestern. This also has Rick LeGros, who is the editor of the original trial, PPCOS 1. So the hypothesis of this study was that higher AMH would be associated with a reduced odds of ovulation. And this is a secondary analysis of the RCT, PPCOS 1, which is almost 20 years old now, or is 20. It was started to be collected 20 years ago, that data. This could probably be better described as a cohort study because it's a secondary analysis, but they're really just looking at association in the whole population. You could call it a prospective cohort study if you like, because they measured all the data at the start, or you could call it a retrospective cohort because this is a hypothesis developed, you know, 15, 20 years after the study. And going back and looking at it, they did not draw AMH levels in that original PPCOS study, but they did have blood frozen. And so they thawed that blood and they had it on about half of the patients. So half of the PPCOS study is represented here. Just a reminder, PPCOS randomized patients, this is a New England Journal of Medicine study, into Clomid with metformin or metformin alone, and didn't find that there was an advantage in the ultimate outcome of pregnancy or birth with the addition of metformin. The authors looked at AMH and its association in several ways. The main one was they divided it into three groups, less than four, 4 to 8, and greater than 8. This might seem random, but they give a reasonable explanation. Levels of AMH between 4 and 5 have been proposed to define PCOS in place of antral follicle count. And so this is sort of looking at patients less than that, in that range, and greater than that. But to make sure that how they divided AMH didn't affect their outcomes, they used AMH as a continuous variable. And then they also looked at tertiles. So they did, you know, multiple ways of looking at AMH to make sure that how they divided up AMH as a unit of measurement wasn't driving their findings. The other thing that's important is there's a lot of confounders in this study and some pretty big ones. You can imagine that age, as your age goes up, your AMH drops. You're probably less more likely to have aneuploidy, less likely to get pregnant. So certainly age is a big confounder here. Also BMI is, because BMI was associated with a reduced odds in ovulation. And BMI also goes up as you age. So there's some interplay between age, BMI, and the association of AMH with both ovulation and outcomes here. So what did they find? Overall, the mean AMH was 12. The standard deviation of that was 8. And so just for our fellows listening, that probably would be better given as a median with IQR than standard deviation. Because if we go two standard deviations below the mean, we get to negative 5 eggs, and that should compromise 95% of our patient population. So we know there has to be a big right tail skew to this. And they say that because the range is 1 to 43. So our average is 11, but most of those patients are going to be to the right of that somewhere. So we have pretty high AMHs in these patients. What did they find? So overall, increased AMH was associated with a reduction in your chances of ovulating. So the odds ratio was 0.92 when it was unadjusted, or 0.9 when it was adjusted. In other words, a 10% reduction in your odds of ovulating for each unit increase in AMH. And we'll talk about sort of how do we clinically make that practical. When they looked at this between the three intervention arms, Clomid, Clomid, and Metformin, that held the same. When they looked at it with AMH linear, that held the same. Whether you use the three groups we described or the tertiles, that finding remained the same. So sort of no matter how they sliced the data, increased AMH was associated with reduction in ovulation. And as I said, as was increasing BMI. They did an ROC curve to try to identify an optimal AMH to identify lack of ovulation. And they got a cutoff of 11.2, and that had a 70% sensitivity and specificity. So performed sort of good, very good, as far as a test to predict that. Maybe good is a better explanation. When we look at live birth, there was no association. It was 1.00 with a tight confidence interval in the unadjusted, and 1.01. So AMH predicts your chance of ovulating, or your odds of ovulating in this case, but it doesn't predict your odds of getting pregnant, probably because they ovulate the next month, you adjust the dose, you go up, you figure out some way to get them ovulatory. So it did not impact the optimal outcome. And there was no threshold over which people became anovulatory. So there was no threshold which they can say, you're not going to ovulate. And so probably we need to talk about IVF. They didn't find that. How does this compare to other studies? Sunny Mumford, who used to be with me at the NIH and is now with Kurt and Enrique Schisterman at Penn, a great epidemiologist, did almost this exact study in PPCOS 2, and she found a 6% reduced odds in ovulating with each unit in AMH. This one found a 10%. So I think it's pretty consistent. What do I like about this study? They looked at AMH in multiple ways. I love sensitivity analyses that do that. I hate when we arbitrarily divide data. They gave a reason for the 4, 4 to 8 to 8. It makes sense. But they slice their data as many ways as possible so that you can't really think it, look at it and say, well, I think slicing the data is what caused this. I really would have liked to see some greater than efficiency curves. In other words, go from a 0 AMH up to 43. And over each threshold, what's the percentage of patients that ovulated? You'd probably see a curve from the population baseline, and you'd see it drop. And it'd just be interesting to see that curve. Is it a straight sort of curve? Is there a sharp decline over a certain AMH? That analysis maybe would have helped us explore that better. And then my final comment is just, you know, I like to put these things into clinical context. So Pietro, a patient sitting in front of you, you say your odds of ovulating are reduced by 10% for each unit increase in AMH. Even I would have a hard time really thinking about that in my mind, and the patient certainly is going to have a hard time. This study doesn't show what the baseline rate of ovulation was in it. They never give us that raw number or raw data, so I had to go back to PPCOS 1, 46% of patients ovulated. Even though half of the patients were included in this study, I'm assuming whether they had AMH, that blood still frozen to measure AMH, wasn't a confounder in that. So I'm making that assumption. So 46%. So what's the odds of ovulating? Well, it's 46 do over 54 don't. So that's an odds of 0.85, which is going to be different than your relative risk, right? Which would be 0.46. So 0.85. So that's going to reduce by 10% for each unit increase. So if you carry that over 10 units of AMH, your chance of ovulating drops from an odds of 0.85 to an odds of 0.33. So again, odds, now we have to translate that to risk. 0.33 is 1 over 3, which is 1 out of 4 from a risk standpoint, 25%. So we've dropped from 46 to 25% moving AMH by 10. If we move in another 10 and go up to 20, we drop it an absolute risk from 25% to 11. So at the end, they conclude that this is clinically helpful to counsel patients. Well, if that's the case, we've got to convert odds into like absolute numbers to,
patients don't understand odds.
And even for me, as someone who gets in the weeds of this kind of stuff, I had to go to another study, pull it, do these conversions to sort of get to that. So I do think if we're going to say something's a counseling tool, we should probably communicate it in a way that both physicians and patients understand it. But this is a really good study. Even though it's small, this is a very well-defined PCOS population. I could get a cohort of, you know, tens of thousands of PCOS patients from my data set, but it's going to be homogenous. It's going to be a mix. This is a very well-defined cohort, and it's very consistent with other literature. So I think we can confidently say as your AMH goes up, your chance of ovulation goes down. Clinically, it is a significant amount. I mean, 46% down to 25% ovulation, that's cutting it in half over an AMH change of 10 points. So probably does matter clinically. So those are my thoughts. Pietro, Kurt, Eve, curious on yours.
When I read this, my first thought was, I guess this is intuitive. We realize that AMH is now becoming a diagnostic prognosticator for PCOS. And I always thought it was the metabolic aspects of PCOS that made people inovulatory, not necessarily just the number of follicles. So I was curious on why the number of follicles and hence a higher AMH might be the leading factor in why people are inovulatory. So I don't think the paper answers this. I think I just had this thought saying that, is this teaching me something new about AMH and being anti-ovulatory, or is this just finding people that are on the extremes of PCOS? So I didn't know if you guys had the same thought.
I had the same thoughts too, Kurt, and I don't know that this paper answers that for us. There certainly were some associations with some of those metabolic parameters and ovulation, but whether that's what's driving it or the AMH is what's driving it, even when they account for that, AMH is still a very strong predictor, suggesting that AMH may have some independent predicting in that. You know, is that sort of some of AMH's role in competitiveness and suppressing follicular development and competing follicles? And if you have enough of that, is it just going to suppress it globally, regardless of that input of Clomid? Maybe that's what's happening. But while it didn't totally drive down into that, I do think it supports that AMH is sort of an independent predictor or association with anovulation.
Again, being redundant, that's what I thought of on this case. Are we learning something new about, you know, the folliculogenesis, or are we just taking the farther extreme you are from the norm, the more likely you are to have abnormal situations of the norm?
Kurt, Micah, I totally agree with you. And I think that the way that I reconcile these data are that AMH shows follicle density. And there were a lot of earlier data that were done by Teresa Woodruff and her team looking at ovarian plasticity. And the idea behind it is if you have an ovary that is chock full of follicles, for lack of a more scientific term, then it may make development of that dominant follicle a lot more difficult. And so the greater your AMH is, the greater the follicle density, the less plasticity within the ovary and the lesser ability of that ovary to form a dominant follicle and therefore ovulate. So I think these data are really interesting in showing that concept in terms of AMH level and just another argument for why AMH is a good predictor. And I think when you think of it that way, it really helps me to visualize what's going on physiologically within the ovary.
I guess the final elephant in the room here is that we're talking about an increasingly outdated way of ovulation induction in PCOS patients. I think the confluence of data over the last several years have really pointed us towards letrozole as probably a better agent for the majority of our patients with PCOS, which is also associated with a much lower rate of failure from an ovulation perspective. So I think you kind of have to keep that in the back of your mind.
That's a really good take-home point, Pietro. I don't know that you could take these data and directly say the relationship would hold the same, or at least the absolute percentage points of people who ovulate is going to be different on letrozole. It's going to be higher.
And we've had some nice studies in fertility and sterility that we've reviewed on the podcast, looking at extending the courses of letrozole for patients who have failed to ovulate with the traditional 5 days of 2.5, 5, and 7.5, extending that to 10 days of oral medication captures a lot of the remaining patients who are anovulatory on max dose letrozole.
Pietro, we're going to move into one of your wheelhouses, which is reproductive surgery. And we're going to talk about the data that's out there on the Davidoff versus the Vecchietti vaginoplasties. Tell us what the data shows.
Yeah, I got a really nice surgical systematic review for you guys this month in FNS. We don't see a lot of these, so it's nice to kind of highlight it, particularly with some procedures that aren't performed all that often in the average REI practice. This is a study entitled Laparoscopic Davidoff versus Laparoscopic Vecchietti Neovaginoplasty in Women with MRKH Syndrome, a systematic review and meta-analysis by Lizanne Martens from the Netherlands. The goal of this paper was to summarize the available evidence on these two techniques in creating a neovagina and compare these techniques with a focus on the neovaginal length, postoperative sexual function, operative time, and complication rate. And if you're paying attention, you're probably wondering, wait, don't we start with dilator therapy to create a neovagina? Yes, you're correct. Sequential vaginal dilation is the mainstay of neovagina creation, and about 75% of patients with vaginal agenesis will achieve a reasonable, successful vaginal length that they can use for intercourse in transvaginal ultrasounds. However, 25% of those patients are going to fail that method, and there are a few surgical options out there for them. In the U.S., the McIndoe neovaginoplasty is the most common procedure performed, and if memory serves us all well, this is where a skin graft is used to cover the formed vaginal canal. It was actually first described in the turn of the century in New York City by Dr. Robert Abbey, a plastic surgeon, but was really revitalized and brought into mainstream in 1938 by Dr. McIndoe at Charing Cross Hospital in the UK. Now, if you were to be in the UK across the pond, the most common procedures are actually the Davidoff and the Vecchietti procedures. The Davidoff procedure, of course, is where you take the rectovesical space, you mobilize it, and you attach it to mobilized peritoneum and create an introitus in a neovaginal vault. This was actually first described in Leningrad in 1974. And Vecchietti, this is the one where I think most medical students' jaw drops when they learn about it. This is where you have that olive that's placed in the vaginal dimple, and then you have a traction device placed on the abdomen. And over the course of weeks, you serially dilate and elongate the vaginal canal. This was described in 1965 in, you guessed it, Italy. For the sake of this paper, we're not going to be talking about the McIndoe. We're just going to be talking about the Davidoff and the Vecchietti procedures. Here's where this paper, I think, is really worth highlighting. They looked at a total of 31 studies, totaling nearly 1,200 patients with MRKH that were undergoing either of these laparoscopic techniques, which is a ton of data for a very rare set of procedures that's performed kind of globally. So what did they learn? So the operative times by each method were actually very different. The Davidoff is a technically much more complicated procedure, surgically demanding, but 2 hours plus on average, whereas compared to the Vecchietti procedure, where you're placing an olive attraction device and suturing it to the abdominal wall, it's about a 40-minute long procedure. As a result, I think you see a little bit play out in the hospitalization stay, the complication rate. So for example, the mean hospital stay for the Davidoff procedure was anywhere from 1 to 18 days compared to 2 to 8 days for the Vecchietti. The Vecchietti procedure, that serial tensioning of the olive, can actually be done on an outpatient basis. You don't need to be inpatient for that. Now, the top line finding here is that the mean vaginal length at 12 months after the Davidoff method was 8.5 centimeters, compared to 8.7 centimeters after the Vecchietti. Essentially the same, which is huge, which basically tells us that you can choose either technique and expect to end up with a very similar neovaginal length. Now, importantly, in the literature, stenosis is only mentioned after the Davidoff procedure, with an incidence ranging from 3 to 15%. There are no stenoses reported in the Vecchietti literature. This is probably because the Davidoff procedure it's just a bigger wound surface. You have new tissues, you have new neovaginal lining that's now consisting of peritoneal tissue. You can imagine a tissue healing effect here where stenosis happens. All of these patients are recommended to undergo dilator therapy post-op, regardless of the technique, to avoid this exact restenosis effect. In terms of complication rate, you guessed it, the both of them were pretty safe, but similar in terms of their complication rate. There was a 9% visceral organ injury rate with the Vecchietti procedure compared to 5% in the Davidoff. But importantly, these visceral injuries in the Vecchietti procedure were just the thread-bearing needle being passed through the anterior abdominal wall, nicking the bladder, which is a kind of a clinically insignificant visceral injury, but nonetheless recorded as a complication of the procedure. And finally, if you're the patient, you're wondering, all right, I have this great new vaginal length. I've had a successful procedure, outpatient. What does my sexual function look like? And for the papers that reported female sexual function index, the FSFI, at 1 year post-op, they actually showed that the sexual functional index at 12 months was similar, 28.9 for the Davidoff versus 27.5 for the Vecchietti. And for those who are unfamiliar with that scale, a total score can range from 2 to 36, higher scores denoting more sexual satisfaction. One important nuance I'll mention here is that a score below 26.5 is able to be categorized as having sexual dysfunction. So although the sexual function scores were similar, they were certainly on the low end of normal and just kind of above that threshold for sexual dysfunction. So yes, you achieved a better surgical length with both techniques. They're comparable, not a totally normal vaginal canal that useful for total normal functioning from a sexual perspective. I love studies like this because these are rare procedures that are performed in certain centers of excellence around the world. And when you have the opportunity to review everything that's been published on the topic, you can really take some high-level findings from this paper. So I'm glad to see it in fertility and sterility. I think it's useful from a counseling perspective for folks that do this kind of work.
I agree with you, Pietro. I mean, Fertility and Sterility is a journal for all of us. Even though these procedures are not commonly done anymore, there's still a lot to learn about people's experiences. And it really was part of our field for a long time, even though it's waned a little bit. So glad the content is still there. And thank you for, you know, those wonderful surgeons and that collection of this great data.
Let's stay with the flow and go out of order. So speaking of good surgical data, we also have a video section in Fertility and Sterility. Now, this doesn't have to be only for surgical videos. It can be for lab techniques, all sorts of ways that video communicates science in an effective way, but these tend to be mostly surgical. And Pietro, we're coming back to you with talking about a V-notes procedure. What is V-notes and why is it applicable to our readers?
You're probably wondering why I'm highlighting a video in a audio-based podcast, but I have to tell you, when I watched this video and reviewed it, my jaw just kind of hit the ground. Like, oh my gosh, this is real surgical innovation for innovation's sake, not necessarily for widespread clinical use, but oh my gosh, people are really pushing the boundaries. So I'm going to try to paint a picture and tell you a little bit about what they did. This paper, this video article is entitled V-notes Retroperitoneal Transient Uterine Artery Occlusion, a new approach to control bleeding during a high-risk evacuation of products of conception by Bakelant et al. From Belgium. So the story goes that this is a 34-year-old woman. She's a G8P3 who has a history of two prior C-sections, a partial molar pregnancy, and a 9-week missed AB that resulted in a 2.8-liter blood loss at the time of her DNC. This patient shows up, she's 10 weeks pregnant, has an HCG of 45,000, and has an ultrasound that reveals a large blood-filled niche within the caesarean scar with a thin overlying myometrium, and then copious amount of material suspicious for a partial mole inside the cavity. Increased vascularization in the myometrium is noted, enhanced myometrial vascularity with markedly elevated arterial flow velocities. This is a molar pregnancy, right? And if you think about this patient who's already had a history of a heavy blood loss with surgical management of a prior pregnancy, you're kind of worried about what this next one's going to look like. And this is a patient who was counseled on options, primarily for fertility preserving treatment, because oftentimes when people have completed their family bearing with this clinical picture, a hysterectomy is certainly considered. And this patient was given a couple options. You could have a straightforward DNC and kind of manage the blood loss as it comes. You can have a preoperative uterine artery embolization. Great idea if you have interventional radiology in-house and available. Some people have also reported doing laparoscopic transient occlusion of the uterine arteries, but requires a certain amount of skill and expertise as well. But this patient opted for this transient occlusion technique, but done in a pretty unique way and paired with a subsequent suction and evacuation of the molar pregnancy. So allow me to paint a picture. In your mind's eye, imagine you're sitting in the operating room, the patient is in stirrups, and you essentially start performing a what looks like a TVH or an anterior posterior repair. You make a vaginal incision just over the bladder, you dissect the vaginal mucosa, and instead of entering anteriorly or posteriorly like you would for a vaginal hysterectomy, you're going to be entering the paravesical space. And you're going to dissect over the arcus tendineus fascia pelvis, and then you're going to enter the pelvic retroperitoneal spaces purposely, and you're going to remain there. So up until now, just like a TVH, but this is really where things differ. Then they place something called a gel point VPATH. And if you've ever seen single site surgery, that's the, imagine a laparoscopic port's placed in the embo, and then you have that gel cover attached to the top of it. Well, they're placing that instrument into the retroperitoneal space. They're insufflating purposely the retroperitoneal space, and then they're passing standard laparoscopic instruments through the gel port. And this is where your jaw kind of drops. You're used to seeing the retroperitoneum. You're used to seeing the median leaflet of the broad ligament all from above laparoscopically. Well, here they're essentially doing the same dissection, but in reverse order from below. They're dissecting into the right obturator fossa. They're dissecting towards the iliac vessels. And eventually, the goal is to identify the internal iliac artery. And as you watch the artery kind of just pumping away at you, you look for the origin of the right uterine artery, and they placed a removable clip on the right uterine artery. And here's the cool part. They really were trying to demonstrate that this technique has a pretty wide range on the contralateral side. On the left side, instead of occluding the right uterine artery, they actually occluded the left internal iliac artery primarily, just to demonstrate the feasibility of the transient occlusion of different caliber vessels with this approach. Importantly, if you're thinking about this, you have to be very careful with those fragile veins. You have to be careful with the ureters. All of those things are kind of in the back of your mind. And once they've transiently occluded the vessels, they perform the DNC under transanal ultrasound, which is a nifty technique. You know, the vagina is occupied with the instrument, so you can place the same transvaginal probe in the rectum and watch as you perform the DNC. They perform the DNC. They monitored for bleeding, took off the clips, and removed the gel point, closed up the patient, and this patient had a less than 500 cc EBL. Had an uneventful post-op course, the HCG was trended to zero, and these folks got to publish a really cool surgical video in FNS as a result of it. And the reason I wanted to highlight this video in particular is that this is a really nice demonstration of a maximally, minimally invasive technique, right? Single site transvaginal surgery avoids the need of interventional radiology, which, you know, is nice when you're in a big academic center, but in lots of the rest of the world and in the community, not easily accessible. It's nice reversible hemostatic control that a uterine artery embolization doesn't offer without the long-term risks associated to the uterus from embolization. And ultimately, it's just innovation for innovation's sake. It's a really cool demonstration of advanced surgical technique, creative thinking, and really kick-ass surgical expertise. So glad to see it in FNS. I encourage everyone, even if you're not a surgeon, to go check it out on the Fertility and Sterility YouTube section, which is just a host of really cool videos that we've published over the course of many years with, I think, nearly 10,000 subscribers to our YouTube channel who've been logging in and watching these videos as they come out. Micah, Kurt, Eve.
That was a great description, Pietro. We get so many good videos, and I think you and I and others, as this came in and we reviewed it, our jaws sort of dropped, as this is a really cool technique to do the things you described from a vaginal approach. So highly encourage our listeners to log in and actually watch this video, especially if you're doing surgeries where this technique might be helpful.
Again, I want to jump in. Fertility and Sterility, under my predecessors, started video articles. These are actually articles indexed in PubMed. They count as a full paper. We're one of the first journals to ever do this. People should look at them and also consider publishing them. This is a great way to showcase academic productivity in ways other than writing a formal article.
Absolutely. And they don't have to just be about surgeries, as we talked about. They can be about other aspects. The IVM group out of Vietnam just published a study where they're getting eggs out of follicles as small as 3 millimeters. And people are asking, how are you doing that in an unstimulated PCO ovary? And so reached out and suggested that they submit a video article of that and show us, how do you retrieve eggs out of 3 millimeter follicles? So there's lots of things that this can be applicable to. We've had presentations on embryology techniques. And so if you have anything that lends yourself to this, this is a very good way to communicate science and evidence. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip our final article and just tease it. It's the cost effectiveness of PGT, a systematic review without a meta-analysis. The short answer is PGTM is cost effective in all the studies that are out there. Probably not surprising, because you're avoiding multi-million dollar diseases like sickle cell disease, Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, for example. On PGTA, most of the studies don't show cost effectiveness. But we're going to have a Journal Club Global on this, led by our European colleagues, Dom de Ziegler and Paul Pertia, in 2 weeks. And we'll drop that as a podcast article as well. Speaking of Journal Club Globals, we had a great one last week on the new practice guideline for subclinical hypothyroidism. Kurt was our host as Pietro was at the State of the Union address. Very good discussion. That should come out in May in the journal. We'll also drop that Journal Club Global as a podcast, but you can log into Fertility and Sterility and look at journal clubs and find that there. I highly recommend that you read that new guideline. Eve, Pietro, Kurt, it was great seeing all three of you this week. Thank you again for all of your leadership with the journal and especially for your advocacy in this month in particular nationally for all of our patients who need access to IVF.
As always, it was great talking about the science with you all. Now more than ever, learning the science of IVF is critically important as new rulings are enacted. And I echo Pietro's sentiment. Thanks for letting me share some of the work that I've been doing outside of this in terms of advocacy on behalf of all of our fertility patients everywhere, not just in Alabama.
Thanks, everybody. It's always wonderful talking about science in the morning. So I hope you all enjoy the podcast and please send us your feedback.
Thanks, Micah, and thanks for the opportunity to share a little bit about what was a really scary week for the field, but also a cool week from an advocacy and perspective.
Thank you to all our listeners. Please, if you haven't already, like the podcast, subscribe to it wherever you get your podcasts from, and we will see you again next month.
This concludes our episode of Fertility and Sterility on Air, brought to you by Fertility and Sterility in conjunction with the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. This podcast is produced by Dr. Molly Kornfield and Dr. Adriana Wong. This podcast was developed by Fertility and Sterility and the American Society for Reproductive Medicine as an educational resource and service to its members and other practicing clinicians. While the podcast reflects the views of the authors and the hosts, it is not intended to be the only approved standard of practice or to direct an exclusive course of treatment. The opinions expressed are those of the discussants and do not reflect Fertility and Sterility or the American Society for Reproductive Medicine.